You know, a person's first reaction to finding out that they're in an organization which is being watched is, well, why are they watching us? I mean, we're not doing anything illegal, which is true. We weren't and we're not. And of course they have to understand why, and people have to explain it to them. You know, why is the state, you know, paying so much attention to an organization whose work is, you know, is public work? And when you get into that, you get into the whole area of what is a state that looks like it's free, unquote, but in fact is extremely repressive.
Welcome to Circle A Radio. Tonight we'll be looking at the history of U.S. government's domestic surveillance programs. The recent cases of the National Security Agency spying on American citizens have now gained widespread media coverage. We're not hearing a lot about other types of intimidation. We'll be speaking with Lauren Regan from the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, Oregon, about how grand juries work and their role in repression. We'll also be speaking with Professor Brian Glick, author of The War at Home, Covert Action Against U.S. Activists and What We Can Do About It. First, we bring you some voices, past and present, of people who are intimately familiar with these tactics. This is former Black Panther Party member and Portland resident Kent Ford.
And I got a call from a friend, and I hadn't heard from this friend for 25 years. But he says, Kent, this is the worst I've ever seen it. He said, even during our day, back in the SNCC days and the Black Panther days, he said, it wasn't this bad. I said, you're certainly right.
If the political repression activists face is worse now than it's ever been, we need to look at the past for lessons learned and for parallels to our current struggles. We put together the following history lesson in an effort to connect the past to the present. Some of the historical material came from a documentary called Me and My Shadow, a history of the FBI's covert operations and COINTELPRO. It was narrated by Don Sorda and produced by Addie Gevins for Pacifica Radio in 1976.
Do you ever get the feeling you are being watched? If you are active in any organization on the left, you probably are.
In 1791, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, or the Bill of Rights, provided legal protection of basic civil rights. Civil liberties guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution included freedom of speech, of the press, and of assembly. The Constitution provided citizens protection from unreasonable search and seizure. In 1798 marked the passing of the Alien and Sedition Acts. These acts were created in part to silence government critics. They granted the president the power to imprison or deport any alien suspected of sedition, and its wide-ranging restrictions of spoken criticism against the government or the president. The Sedition Act significantly reduced First Amendment protections of speech and of the press. During the period between 1860 and 1865, the first violations of First Amendment protections were documented during the Civil War. During wartime paranoia, the U.S. government censored telegraph communications and punished journalists for publishing opinion editorial pieces. Newspapers critical of the Lincoln administration were banned from the mail. In 1962, Lincoln established military tribunals. Any U.S. citizen accused of resisting military drafts or guilty of giving aid and comfort to the rebels would be tried under military law. Hundreds of civilians were arrested and tried in military tribunals. Thus, they were denied the constitutional protection of trial by jury in a civilian court. With the entry of the United States into World War I, the government became increasingly concerned about rising anti-war sentiment by the labor and radical movements. Organized labor was lobbying for their right to collective bargaining, as well as reduced working hours and better working conditions. By order of the War Department, police were authorized to repress any activities committed under the term seditious intent. The government stepped up its campaign of repression against activists and foreign immigrants. In 1917, Congress passed the Espionage Act. It prescribed a $10,000 fine and 20 years imprisonment for interfering with recruitment of troops or the disclosure of information dealing with national defense. Criticized as unconstitutional, the act resulted in the imprisonment of many in the anti-war movement, including Eugene V. Debs, Max Eastman, and Emma Goldman. In 1918, the Sedition Act was further refined to make it illegal to criticize the war effort in almost any manner.
This is David Cole, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and legal affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine.
In 1919, there were a series of terrorist bombings in the United States, including mail bombs that were delivered to one of the chief justices of the Supreme Court, to several senators, including a person who blew off the front of the home of Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. And the government responded at that time not by going out and capturing the bombers. They never found the bombers. Instead, they went out and picked up somewhere between 4,000 and 10,000 foreign nationals using immigration authority, locked them up, interrogated them incommunicado, and ultimately deported hundreds of them, not based on involvement in terrorism, not based on involvement in the bombing, but based on either pretextual immigration charges, overstaying visas, or political association with the Communist Party or some communist organization.
These raids took place in several American cities and became known as the Palmer Raids.
And they used immigration law at the time because they could. Not because they thought the bombers were immigrants, but because the laws permitted them to do to foreign nationals what they couldn't do to citizens, to employ guilt by association, to hold people without showing them the evidence against them. And the architect of that was not Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, but a young man just out of George Washington Law School, whose first job in the Justice Department had been regulating enemy aliens during World War I, and whose second job was heading up the Radical Alien Division of the Justice Department. And that man was J. Edgar Hoover.
Me and my shadow strolling down the
The legal scope of FBI operations has been increasing since its formation in 1924. Political surveillance is handled by the Bureau's Domestic Intelligence Division, which dates its authority from 1939, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt ordered the FBI to investigate matters relating to espionage and sabotage. So long as J. Edgar Hoover and his successors to the directorship could convince the legislature that the government is in imminent danger of communist subversion, funds could be obtained for extensive programs of domestic surveillance. Programs which are subject to only the most minimal review by elected representatives of the people.
After the December 7, 1941 Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Roosevelt delegated military authority to sign Executive Order 9066, which culminated in the internment of ethnic Japanese from West Coast communities. After the Second World War ended, the Cold War began. Between 1947 and 1954, the House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, had been officially established. Its purpose was threefold. First, it intended to prove that the Hollywood Screenwriters Guild had communist members. Second, it hoped to show that these writers were able to insert subversive propaganda into Hollywood films. Third, J. Parnell Thomas, head of the committee, argued that President Roosevelt had encouraged pro-Soviet films during the war. Although none of these claims were ever substantiated, the committee's tactics forced many talented and creative people to leave Hollywood. Between 1947 and 1954, more than 50 explicitly propagandistic anti-communist films were made in Hollywood. During this time, U.S. Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy led intense anti-communist inquiries, later known as witch hunts.
This is Bill Mandel, who was a KPFA radio programmer for 37 years. He's testifying in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1960.
My name is William Mandel. I live at 233 Lake Drive, Berkeley.
You're appearing today in response to a subpoena which is heard upon you by this committee?
I do.
And you're represented by counsel?
I am.
Counsel?
To the degree that a counsel not able to speak for me can represent me.
Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Communist Party?
Sir, I am 42 years of age and have never had to face a jury as defendant or grand jury as witness in my life. I have committed no crime under any of the laws of this country and am not engaged in subversion. Consequently, I refuse to testify on the grounds that as a radio and TV public affairs broadcaster active in those capacities today, the subpoena issued to me interferes with the rights of my stations to schedule informational programs on their merits, and is thus a direct violation of the First Amendment guarantee of freedom of speech and of the people's right to hear. I certainly shall not answer questions representing allegations against me made by persons not present and not identified, whom I cannot confront and whom my lawyer cannot cross-examine as to their truthfulness.
Do you honestly apprehend, sir, that if you told this committee truthfully while you're under oath whether or not you are now this instant or ever have been a member of the Communist Party, you would be supplying information which might be used against you in a criminal proceeding?
Honorable beaters of children and sadists uniformed and in plain clothes, distinguished Dixiecrat wearing the clothing of a gentleman, eminent Republican who opposes an accommodation with the one country with which we must live at peace in order for us all and our children to survive. My boy of 15 left this room a few minutes ago in sound health and not jailed solely because I asked him to be in here to learn something about the procedures of the United States government and one of its committees. Had he been outside, where the son of a friend of mine had his head split by these goons operating under your orders, my boy today might have paid the penalty of permanent injury or a police record for desiring to come here and hear how this committee operates. If you think that I am going to cooperate with this collection of Judases, of men who sit there in violation of the United States Constitution, if you think I will cooperate with you in any way, you are insane.
Now, sir, were you a lecturer?
In 1956, the Federal Bureau of Investigation launches its counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO.
Earth First organizer Judy Berry.
what they did to us was, the term for this in the FBI is COINTELPRO, Counterintelligence Program. And what that means, this is a program that was started by J. Edgar Hoover back in the bad old days, and now in the bad new days, they still do it. And COINTELPRO, that J. Edgar Hoover described, it's a way of targeting domestic radical groups that they think are a threat to the U.S. government. So I guess that's quite a compliment to us. I guess we're a threat to Charles Hurwitz, and he's more powerful than the government, so maybe it all adds up. But anyway, what J. Edgar Hoover described COINTELPRO as a program, these are his words, to expose, misdirect, isolate, and neutralize political groups that he didn't like. And that's really what's been done to Earth First. And the methods that they used in COINTELPRO include disinformation, fake documents, infiltration, agent provocateurs, fomenting infighting within a group, getting the group to do things so that they will be discredited, and also framing and assassinating leaders. And the most famous victims of COINTELPRO, you probably all know that Martin Luther King was spied on in his motel room. And that, you know, of course, in the Black Panthers, there were many Panthers killed, 32 in all. Fred Hampton was a famous victim of COINTELPRO. He was murdered in his bed. Geronimo Pratt, and he, in fact, was framed by the very same guy, Richard Held, the same guy that was in charge of our case at the FBI was in charge of Geronimo's case down in Los Angeles. Leonard Peltier is another very well-known victim of COINTELPRO. And what they did in these cases, in the Black Panthers, they didn't just frame Geronimo. Before they framed him and put him in jail, they fomented infighting within the leadership so that people in the Black Panthers thought that Geronimo was an FBI agent, so that when he was then framed, the other Panthers wouldn't testify in his behalf. And one of the ways that they fomented this infighting is that they had these, like, nasty cartoons. Now, the FBI doesn't make up the divisions in your group. They take real divisions, and they kind of fan the flames of them. So there was another group, a black nationalist group, as opposed to a black revolutionary group, which was the Panthers was, and the other group was called United Slaves, or US, U.S. And the leader of the United Slaves was named Karenga. So what they did is they had these cartoons, and these cartoons were sent from one faction to the other and back and forth, cartoons, death threats, and insulting letters, and each faction thinking that the cartoons and letters were from the other faction, and they were all from the FBI until everybody, there were actually two Panthers killed in the fighting that resulted from this, which they considered a great success.
Editor-in-Chief of the Intercommunal News Service of the Black Panther Party discusses the relationship of the FBI to that organization.
There is a host of evidence suggesting the active participation and involvement of paid agents, informers, and contract agents of the various intelligence services of this country, alleged intelligence services of this country, their participation in the activities of the party as members and as leaders.
This is Bobby Seale, founder, chairman, and national organizer of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense.
I mean, by the end of 1969, I had 29 Black Panther Party members dead. 14 policemen were dead. And all those shootouts and attacks on our offices, because the particular year of 1969, they attacked every Black Panther Party office in this country at least once. Black Panther Party was one of the most profound, take no crap from the racist pig power structure, grassroots, progressive, class analysis style organization, which evolved out of the grassroots of the African American community in this country. Black Panther Party was not separate from the civil rights movement, it was part of it. In fact, the Black Panther Party, because they murdered Martin Luther King, was catapulted into a broad spokesman but program organizing kind of leadership angle in opposition to what we call the racist pig power structure. I mean, the FBI counterintelligence program, that program, what they call the COINTELPRO, you can go to the Library of Congress right now and read, really, all the dirty tricks and the violation of constitutional rights of the Freedom of Information Act documents. You can read this stuff. You got still people laboring around here that the Black Panther Party was a black militant hate group. Oh, please, give me a break. We didn't have time for it. You're getting shot at going to jail. You want all the friends you could get. And anyway, we picked up from Mao Zedong in a little red book, know the difference between your friends and your enemies. Another thing we picked up, we began to find out that some of these fools coming in our organization were nothing but black provocative agents sent in by the FBI. So it ain't got nothing to do with no cops. It has to do, I guess, with Martin Luther King would say, the content of your character. That's what it had to do with.
Lewis Tackwood worked as an undercover informer for the criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department. He claims that he also worked for the FBI. In November 1971, Tackwood testified at the trial of 13 Panther Party members in Los Angeles. That trial stemmed from a 1969 attack on Black Panther headquarters by an FBI-trained SWAT team of the Los Angeles Police Department.
The chief prosecution witness in that trial was Melvin Cotton Smith, a leading member of the L.A. Panthers at the time of the alleged shootout.
U.S. Deputy District Attorney Ronald H. Carroll maintained that Smith had turned state's evidence to avoid prosecution. Tackwood testified that Smith had been an informer since 1969.
Lewis Tackwood's testimony revealed an insider's view of the extent of FBI infiltration.
District Attorney Carroll asked me, I think, one question. What did I know about the Panther Party at the present time? I think I asked him which one, either the police department's Panther Party or the Panther Party, you know.
There are mountains of evidence that those individuals, some of whom have been revealed, others of whom have not, acted in ways to provoke confrontations between the party and the police and other armed elements of the power structure. The Black Panther Party considers 26 members, former members, as martyrs, having fallen in the course of the struggle, the history of this organization.
In 1971, files were stolen from the Bureau's office in Media, Pennsylvania, by a group calling itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. Information contained in those files has enabled other investigators to obtain more documents by suing the Bureau under the Freedom of Information Act. The heavily censored documents turned over by the FBI as a result of those suits revealed the existence of extensive domestic counterintelligence programs called COINTELPROs. They used legal and illegal methods to infiltrate, disrupt, and harass politically active citizens.
Congressman Ron Dellums reads from one of these documents.
Counterintelligence program, internal security.